Actually, I saw the first 10 minutes of Hamilton, and the guys around him are clearly just as talented, if not more talented, as far as they're singing and rapping. But he's a motherfucker who sat down, as far as I know, thought of this and wrote it out. So that's why he's got millions of dollars. So that's what we need to do. It's all about who can create this shit.
Welcome back to the Renaissance, episode 125.
Hello.
I didn't know Leonardo. You were. Yeah, I am. Yeah. It's because you were ranting. Leonardo liked juxtaposing sketches of pretty boys facing craggy older men in his notebooks, Ray.
Yes. Now, this is important to remember. He was doing this before Salai comes along. So it's not like he sees this kid and he goes, oh my God, you've inspired me in my pen and my penis, whatever. He was doing it before. And again, on one hand, you would have this androgynous, curly-haired pretty boy facing an older man with a craggy face and a jutting chin. And I just think he was fascinated by that, you know, one extreme, the other extreme, night and day. And also, you could argue that this is what I looked like when I was young, and sadly, this is what I will look like one day in the future. And I just think he liked the juxtaposition, the contrast. And it was something that he did over and over and over again in his notebooks.
Hmm. And he wrote about it, too. He wrote, yes. In narrative paintings, you should closely intermingle direct opposites because they offer a great contrast to each other, especially when they are adjacent. Thus, have the ugly one next to the beautiful, the large sure. next to the small, the old next to the young, which is basically describes our podcast.
Pretty so, much. Oh, you meant... Oh, I didn't tell you about Cheryl.
Particularly... Sorry. When we're shooting this, we're running this video and we're side by side on the screens, and I can see it right there: the ugly next to the beautiful, the large next to the small.
Shouldn't talk to yourself.
The old next to the young. Right. It's all. That's why this is the perfect podcast. Well, British art historian Kenneth. Yeah.
It's going to get worse over the summer as I refuse to bathe, because why bathe when you have a pool? So what you see now, this is as good as it's going to get all summer long. It's going downhill from here. Please continue.
It's been going downhill since I knew you, since I've known you. Every Sorry. Year I'm like, oh, so I'm getting better as I get older. Clean bill of health, 100%. I'm the healthiest I've ever been, according to my cardiologist.
I'm going downhill.
Anyway. According to the British art historian Kenneth Clark, most typical of such creations is the bald, clean-shaven man with formidable frown, nutcracker nose and chin.
Right.
See, if you just shave the beard off, that would be you, right?
Yeah.
Who appears sometimes in the form of a caricature, more often as an ideal. His strongly accentuated features seem to have typified for Leonardo vigor and resolution. And so he that leaves you out. And so he becomes the counterpart of that other profile, which came with equal facility from Leonardo's pen, the Epicene youth. These are, in fact, the two hieroglyphs of Leonardo's unconscious mind, the two images his hand created when his attention was wandering, virile and effeminate. They symbolize the two sides of Leonardo's nature.
I wanted to ask your opinion on this, because we know he started doing this juxtaposition thing in 1478 before Salai comes along. So on one hand, is he just a gay guy going, oh, this is me as an old guy and I want a beautiful young thing next to me for the rest of my life, you know, whatever. To me, that just seems too simple, seems too pat. I almost can't help but think of it as like he's in 38. He's in the middle of his life. He's drawing. This is what I looked like when I was young. I was beautiful, the tight curly hair, yada, yada, yada. And this is me when I'm going to get older. No tightness, no hair, big giant chin and ears and nose. And it's almost like he's just in the middle of the two bookends of his life. I don't know. It's almost like he's contemplating his past and his future at the same time, as opposed to it's just an old guy who wants to see a beautiful young boy. I just couldn't really wrap my head around the fact that it's nothing more than a sexual comparison between old and young. I thought it went a lot deeper than that. What about you?
I think he invented Snapchat filters. He's applying like an old filter and a youthful filter on himself, and then just screenshotting them and posting them up. Look, this is me as a young boy, and this is me as an old man. Boom.
And when I feel better, I fold half the paper so I can only see the youthful side. And when I'm being realistic, it's normally on Monday mornings, I unfold and I can see what I'm going to look like in the future. And I go, hey, for right now, not that bad. Not that bad.
Yeah, but the earliest known pair of profiles like this that he drew is in a notebook from when he was 1478, still in Florence, where he would have been mid to late 20s. He was born in 1452, so he's like 26 when he draws the first one of these. Right. Still a young man, still in his prime, still good looking. So he's neither the old man or the young boy. But on this page in 1478, he wrote, Fioravante di Domenico of Florence is my most beloved friend, as though he were my ... Ooh,
so fancy. A little window into his world. Yeah.
Yeah, this is around about the time when he's up on charges in Florence for butt fucking. Right. So he's not finishing that sentence, so it can't be held against him in a court of law. But he's saying basically this guy, Fioravante di Domenico, is his lover, I guess. So there is some connection, even though he's only 26, there is some connection between these, it would seem, and his attraction to, I mean, I don't know who Fioravante di Domenico was and how old he was, but maybe he was a younger boy and there was some sort of a connection there. But when Sally moves in with him, he starts drawing these pictures more and more in his notebooks, and also drawing Sally more and more over the years. He starts drawing him almost immediately when he's 10 years old. Right. He draws him over the course of the next couple of decades. He gets older and older in these pictures, and buffer and fleshier and more muscular.
Yeah.
There's like at least one naked drawing of him that I remember was with his back facing the viewer, and he's built like a Rubenesque woman, like he's or a muscular man, like he's very big and muscly and buff.
And the arms are stretched out so you can see it. Yeah, yeah.
I don't know what he's doing, like what his workout regimen was, Sally, but it's pretty impressive. Like he, he had the body of a Schwarzenegger.
That's right. Likely enough. I think, obviously, taking vitamin D, keeps you spry because he's taking it a lot. No, what I thought was interesting, one, you said that Leo draws him a lot over the years. So on one hand, we get to see Sally grow up. That's pretty cool. Two, when Sally moves into his house, the old man, young man juxtaposition drawings that Leo was doing started becoming a little more sultry. It wasn't just youth, innocence, and old man. It was like there's a little bit of sexist on a stick right there. So I think Sally helps change Leo's perception in that. But at the same time, yeah, so we get to see him grow up. And in the drawings, if you kind of line a couple of them up together, you can see it doesn't matter that he's growing older and that his body's changing. Leo is quite aware of all of the little minute changes in his body. He's able to capture them all. I think this was just a labor of love, Leo drawing Sally as he progressed and got older. I think Leo just enjoyed doing that. And maybe he did it when he had bad days or he needed to be distracted. But again, I think it was something that brought him pleasure. And there was a certain whatever level of affection between these two.
He's like Leonardo DiCaprio drawing Kate Winslet in the Titanic. Right. It's like, lie down.
I'm going to need a moment.
Show me your boobs.
Yeah.
In these drawings of Sally, he often looks angelic, but also devilish, like you, Ray. Down. Like,
thank you. Oh, that wasn't a compliment. Will you quit sending mixed signals? God damn.
Now, it's thought by scholars that the face of the old man that usually accompanies these drawings might be Leonardo drawing a caricature of himself to sort of convey his own fears of his own aging. Mm-hmm. Even in the last years of his life, he's drawing Sally in 1517, 2 years before he died. So he would have been around 65. He was still drawing Sally as a youth.
Right.
Now, this is in a drawing that he did where he's depicting the characters of pleasure and pain. He's got a young character depicting pleasure that kind of looks like Sally, who is sort of standing back to back and intertwined with pain, an older figure, an older man. Leonardo wrote, "Pleasure and pain are represented as twins because there is never one without the other."
Nice.
And like most of his allegorical drawings, there's lots of symbols and puns in this. Pain is standing on mud while pleasure is standing on gold. Pain is dropping little spiked balls called tribolo, which is a play on the word tribolazione or tribulation. Pleasure, on the other hand, is dropping coins and holds a reed. And Leonardo explained that the reed is meant to evoke evil pleasures that are the source of pain. He wrote, "Pleasure here is represented with a reed in his right hand, which is useless and without strength, and the wounds it inflicts are poisoned. In Tuscany, they are used to support beds to signify that it is here that vain dreams come." So apparently the vain dreams are sort of sexual fantasies, and might have suggested that Leonardo thought that sex and sexual fantasies take you away from getting on with work. He wrote, "It is here that much precious time is wasted and many vain pleasures are enjoyed, both by the mind in imagining impossible things and by the body in partaking of those pleasures that are often the cause of the failing of life."
Wow.
So I'm wasting all my time having butt sex with this young man when I could be studying vortexes of water. What am I doing with my life? I'm wasting my life away.
Or finish a fucking painting because you're still carrying around one. But I wanted to ask you about that. Yeah, so on one hand, I think he's stepping outside of himself going, yes, when I'm with Sally, and when I say with him, I mean, you know, biblically.
Inside him.
That's a good time. And as soon as I'm done and that part of me is spent and I can think clearly now because I've gotten it out, yeah, you're right. I could have been working. I could have been painting. I could have been studying. I could have been following around a troop of birds or whatever and figuring out flight patterns or whatever the fuck he does. But I think it's his own contrast about clearly I'm capable of doing a lot, but that doesn't mean I can't have fun, or does it? I can't sleep. I can't eat. Does he have fun or pleasure and then feels bad about it because he's could have been doing something? I mean, in some ways, he seems to just a very almost anxious or driven or perfectionist person who can't decide what is the best course that he should take. And so he has these vain dreams about having fun when I could have been working.
I get that. I used to feel that a lot. For decades, I wouldn't read a I wouldn't read a fiction book. Right. I mean, because I felt that was a waste of time. I should be reading nonfiction. I should be learning something that would be useful.
Sure.
I used to, you know, play some Xbox games and stuff, and I'd feel guilty about wasting time doing that when I should be doing something productive. I should be working.
Right.
I don't really feel guilty about taking some downtime and doing that stuff these days, particularly if the fictional work I'm reading is like a classic, like I read Lolita and I'm reading Dostoevsky and different, you know, I'd go back and read classics that I've read. I feel that's worthy. But, yeah, like, I don't know. I kind of get that a little bit. But I've never felt that about sex, I got to say. I've never gone, you know what, I should spend less time fucking and more time working. Yeah, thought has never crossed my mind. In fact, the opposite is usually in my head. Right. I should spend more time.
Fucking more. Yeah. So what we're saying basically is out of all the things that Leonardo has created, he also created the concept of work-life balance. Fuck me. I mean, this guy just does everything.
He's bad. He said work-life balance is bad. I should be working more. And
I see that sweet ass go by and I'm like, put the pen down. Come here, boy. Anyway.
I wonder what he means by he says, it's in the bed that vain pleasures are enjoyed, both by the mind in imagining impossible things.
Right.
And by the body in partaking. I wonder what the impossible things are that he's fantasizing about in bed. Yeah. Is it like dreaming about, like, if I was recognized as the greatest artist in the world? Or is he talking about orgies with lots of young boys and the Pope and Sforza all getting in and a donkey and lubing up and going for it? I wonder what these impossible things are. What's impossible to Leonardo da Vinci?
Yeah, so clearly there's something that's... Because no one's perfect. As amazing as he is, no one's flawless or perfect. So there's something that's bothering him. Even at the very least, it's, oh my God, there's not enough time to do all the things and to learn all the things I want to do. Because I see myself getting older. So maybe he's frustrated with time and mortality. Who knows?
There never seems to be enough time to do the things you want to do when time is something. I've looked around enough to know that you're the one I want to go through time with.
Are you singing to me right now? Or
Roger Miller.
In general.
Roger Miller? Yeah.
I don't know. I love that song, though.
Yeah, I think it's a Roger Miller song. My dad had a Roger Miller record when I was a kid. Mm. I love that song. And he also sang Roger Miller was on the same record. It was like, dum, 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 trailers for sale or rent, rooms to let 50 cents, no home, no job, no something, ain't got no cigarettes, but 2 hours of pushing broom buys a 8x12 bedroom. I'm a man of means by no means. King of the road. Nice. Butchered that. So Leonardo talks about the useless reed that pleasure holds. Mm-hmm. And says, if you take pleasure, know that he has behind him one who will deal you tribulation and repentance.
Mm.
So, I don't know.
Is it Catholic?
Maybe.
You sound like guilty.
Well, maybe it's a... Yeah, but maybe it's an ass fucking thing. He's like, you know what?
Oh,
yeah, I could get in trouble for all this ass fucking that I'm doing with young boys, but I can't stop.
Can't stop, won't stop.
Yeah. Shit, did we say that at the same time? This is getting bad.
Our cycles are sinking. Anyway, but
don't stop until you get enough.
Yeah, but finally, we've talked about pageants, we've talked about sweet little boys, we've talked about Leo fucking around for, 8 to 10 years or whatever it is when he gets there, but finally becomes what I'd like to think that Eminem would call an opportunity to really make a big splash in the court and to finally use some of his other talents. We'll see how it works out.
Yeah. In 1487, so he's been in Milan for a few years.
Right.
Milan wanted to build a lantern tower, something called a Tiburio, mm-hmm. on top of their cathedral. They'd been trying to do it for years, had a bunch of architects have a crack at it. No one was really happy with designs they came up with.
Yeah.
Leonardo thought this was a great opportunity to prove himself as an architect.
Yeah.
This is the same year he'd come up with his plans for the ideal city that we talked about in an earlier episode. Right. They'd been ignored. But this is something practical.
Right. And they want it. The city wants it.
Exactly. Yes.
Yes.
So there's a design competition, like we've seen before, to design the Tiburio. This cathedral is 100 years old. It's a Gothic cathedral.
Right. Yeah.
But it didn't have a lantern tower. And, you know, he's going to propose something that's a little bit more modern, a little bit more practical than the Gothic design, being Leonardo.
Yes.
So at least 9 architects we know about entered this 1487 competition. And unlike good old Brunelleschi and Alberti when they were entering the competition to design the doors and then the Duomo and that kind of stuff, these guys were sharing ideas with each other. They were sort of collaborating on it.
Yeah.
They were kind of socialist about the whole thing.
Good for them.
And Leonardo had the opportunity to work with 2 of the best architects working in Italy at the time, Donato Bramante and Francesco Di Giorgio.
Nice.
And they all became close friends,
aww.
Unlike Brunelleschi and Alberti, who pretty much hated each other for the rest of their lives.
Dick.
Right. And More importantly, all of this led to a set of drawings based on the writings of the great ancient Roman architect Vitruvius, and gave us the Vitruvian Man drawing that everyone knows and love, Leonardo's attempt to symbolize the harmonious relationship between man and the universe.
Right. Now, what I thought was interesting, and because we have not said this yet in this series on Leonardo, Leonardo's finally going to meet some people pretty close to being on his level. They're multi... disciplinarians like himself. They're doing architect, art, music, engineering, you know, whatever. They're kind of on his level. So when they get together and they work together, obviously they can produce some impressive things. But again, like you said, 9 people have entered this contest. Only one person or one group or whatever could win. But at least now Leo, for all of his troubles, for having, even though he enjoyed putting up pageants and all that kind of stuff, we want him to paint and we want him to build things and be an engineer and an architect. And finally, he's getting this chance and he's meeting these guys. And I really do think that they're going to help him raise his game in this area because they've got skills too. And unlike like Florence, they are going to share, they're going to talk to each other, they're going to lift each other up. And for, I think what happened, what becomes of all this is a very intense and supportive relationship. And even people like Leonardo could occasionally use something like that.
Indeed. He found a like mind, a bit like you and me doing this podcast. Exactly. Found brothers.
We've synced.
A few years after Leonardo and Bramante became friends, Bramante painted a fresco that featured 2 ancient philosophers, Heraclitus and Democritus.
Mm.
Tell me everything you know about Heraclitus, Ray.
I don't know anything about Heraclitus except for, was he the one that was amused by the human condition and so thought a lot of, not thought human suffering was hilarious, but he certainly appreciated that, hey, that shit happens and it's real and don't take it personally.
No.
But I, no, was it that the was other democr- one?
That was Democritus.
Damn! 50-50 chance and I fucked it up. So, no,
Heraclitus.
I don't have anything for you.
Heraclitus wrote a single work that we know of. It's called On Nature. Only fragments of it have survived.
Right.
Famous for the saying, no man ever steps in the same river twice.
Oh, deep.
Basically talking about how everything changes. And so, every time you step in the river, it's a new river.
Right.
It's moved on. He also had the saying, everything flows, or in Greek, panterai.
Panterai.
Which reminds me of your nickname in high school, Panties Ray. Or Panties Raid.
Right.
Panty Raid.
Panty Raid Ray.
You were known as...
Yeah.
Panty Raid Ray, yeah, because you do panty raids all the time.
No, they kept taking my panties. Anyway, we don't have to talk about it. It took me years of therapy to get over it. We don't have to talk about it.
They'd say, hey, everyone, panty raid, raid. And they'd run and take your panties in.
And it got to the point where
I
just took the panties off myself and handed it to them. So, whatever. Anyway.
Can't stand ya.
Love that. So,
Heraclitus is considered the first genuine philosopher, lived 535 to 475 BCE. Democritus lived 460 to 370 BCE, and he and his teacher Leucippus came up with the idea that everything is made of atoms,
right.
The founder of atomic theory.
Yeah.
Around about 370 BCE. Yeah, well, you know what? Everything's made of atoms.
Yeah.
Can't see it, can't prove it. And so Democritus, but he said, but it makes sense if you think about it, right? And this is Lucretius wrote about when he wrote On the Nature of Things, which was De Rerum Natura, where he said, if you just watch rock, it gets hit by water, it disappears bit by bit, it gets washed away, gets smaller and smaller. Something's disappearing from it.
Yes.
What is it? It must be made up of very, very tiny things that we can't see, but we can infer there just by observation. So he's called the father of modern science. He's the one that was known to be amused by the human condition.
Thank you.
Because he was like, you know, it's just all atoms, baby. Yeah. It's three illusions. It's just all atoms. Well, don't get hung up on shit, you know. I know you think you're a human and that this is all real, but really it's just atoms. So just laugh about it and move on. So in this painting, this fresco that Bramante did, Democritus is laughing, Heraclitus is crying. Now, Democritus in the painting is... looks like you, round-faced and balding, says.
Uncalled for.
There you go. It's taken to be a self-portrait of Bramante. Ray's just pulled out his Bowie knife. he keeps it on his desk. Why?
For comments like that. Know. Hurtful comments like that. Anyway,
so Cheryl, I thought it's... Yeah, when Cheryl...
she likes it.
...doesn't bring you a coffee
every
8.5 minutes.
Oh, you know what happened last time, Cheryl? That happened. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
I want you to bring me a vodka martini and then bring another 2 8.5 minutes after that, and then another 2 7.25 minutes after that, and then just every 2 minutes after that reduced. Until one of us passes
exactly.
out.
Exactly, yes.
And the other one, the portrait of Heraclitus is supposed to be based on Leonardo. He's got... flowing, tightly curled hair, a rose-coloured tunic, big eyebrows and a chin, and the book that's open in front of him has got mirror script, right-to-left mirror script. So, he doesn't have a beard yet, but this is, we assume, a portrait of what Leonardo looked like in his prime at the time.
Right. So,
one of the very few contemporary portraits of Leonardo.
Before he does his ZZ Top beard. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, Bramante had been on retainer as the artist, engineer, architect of the Sforza court for many years. Right. The sort of the job, the perfect job that Leonardo really wanted.
Yes.
And a few years after this, Sforza commissioned Bramante to rework the convent of the Santa Maria delle Grazie, the Saint Mary of Thanks, of the Thanks, by adding a new dining hall.
Right.
And Leonardo was hired to paint a depiction of the Last Supper on the wall.
He's got some ideas.
So, funnily, we've never heard of that Last Supper. No one knows what happened to that painting, where it ended up.
It'll probably pop back up at some time.
Yeah, I'm sure, someone knows where it is.
Yes.
Now, Leonardo received 6 payments, July through September 1487, for his work on that project.
Nice.
And we'll talk about that at some stage, I guess. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
In one of the sort of discussions that he and Bramante had on this, Bramante and Da Vinci were both big on fake perspective. Before this, Bramante had to work on, the section of a church where a choir sings, and it was very narrow in this particular church. So he did a painting of it, which made it look like it was bigger than it was. He painted around it to play with perspective. So he and Leonardo were both big fans of Masaccio, big fans of using perspective to create an illusion of depth or reality. Which, of course, remember when we had one of the scholars on the show talking about the Last Supper. Right. He was talking about the perspective of the Last Supper and, what a breakthrough painting that was in terms of its use of perspective, how it's sort of the masterpiece. Leonardo pitched Bramante on the idea of this connection between human bodies and buildings. He said medicines, when properly used, restore health to invalids, and a doctor will make the right use of them if he understands the nature of man. This too is what the sick cathedral needs. It needs a doctor architect who understands the nature of the building and the laws on which correct construction is based.
Nice.
So he's trying to say this is getting back to the cathedral that they wanted to build the tower on.
Right.
He's saying it's a sick cathedral. It needs to be fixed with the right kind of approach.
And not only that, but remember when we said he was writing up his ideas for the ideal city, one of the first things that Leo did was compare the city to the human body. The human body needs to take good stuff in, water, sustenance, food, and it needs to remove the bad stuff, whether it's feces or whatever, or illness, or whatever, you get it out. The same thing with the building. So again, he's comparing these complete systems or organisms with the buildings, and they each have a purpose and they need to support each other. And because he's comparing that and he's sharing this ideas with his friend thinks this the same way. So it's all an example of something else. It's another connection between different parts of the universe, a building, a body, an animal, it doesn't matter. And so again, these guys think along the similar lines. So they're going to be a very good fit for each other, and they're really going to be supportive of each other. And so
yeah,
they're working on this together.
Apparently this old cathedral, 100 years old, it had lots of cracks, had lots of problems, weaknesses in the building, and he was trying to figure out how to solve all of those. Lots and lots of drawings in his notebooks about fissures in walls and weaknesses in buildings, and he did a systematic study on the origins of fissures in walls. He wrote, the cracks that are vertical are caused by the joining of new walls with old ones, for the indentations cannot bear the great weight of the wall added onto them, so it is inevitable that they should break. So typical Leonardo, he's not just going to do a shoddy job on this stuff. He's doing a scientific analysis.
Yeah.
Of the problems in these buildings.
Yeah, I can just picture him walking around the building. Okay, a crack is going horizontally. What does that mean? Why did it happen? Where did it come from? A crack goes this way. What does that mean? How is the building compromised? And what can we do to make sure this whole thing doesn't come crashing down when we build the tower on it? So again, typical Leo, looking at the problems, observing in minute detail. Why did it happen? What can we do about it? So again, that's what he's bringing to the table, and he's doing a great job because of his observational skills.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that I've really learned to appreciate about Leonardo with these sorts of issues. Like everything he tackles, it would seem, he tackles it scientifically and methodically from the get-go. He doesn't slapdash anything. Everything that he does has to be carefully thought through and planned out. He's not going to jimmy anything together, right? Everything has to be very, very perfectly planned.
Well,
he doesn't have a lot of time for ass fucking. He's got to think this stuff through.
The scientific approach takes time. It really does.
Yes. Now, when he was looking at the weaknesses of the cathedral in Milan, he devised a system of buttresses to stabilize the area around where the tower was going to go. But he had to do some experiments. So he designed an experiment to test how they should work. He wrote, an experiment to show that a weight placed on an arch does not discharge itself entirely on its columns. On the contrary, the greater the weight placed on the arches, the less the arch transmits the weight to the columns. Let a man be placed on a weighing device in the middle of a well shaft, then have him push out his hands and feet against the walls of the well. You will find that he weighs much less on the scales. If you put weights on his shoulders, you will see for yourselves that the more weight you put on him, the greater will be the force with which he spreads his arms and legs and presses against the wall, and the less will be his weight on the scales.
Damn. He took that to 11, didn't he?
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So you're pushing your arms out to stabilize yourself against the walls.
And now I weigh less on the scale because some of my pressure or force or weight is now on the walls, projected onto the walls.
Yeah.
To me, that's
not going down.
Counterintuitive, but I'm sure this motherfucker probably did 27 experiments with Salai or someone else. Get down in that well. No, we're going to do an experiment. Get down in there. I mean, incredible.
Yeah.
But he's a perfectionist.
So,
yeah.
So then he built a wooden model for his design for the tower using a carpenter's assistant he hired. He got paid for that in 1488.
Nice.
And his design didn't try to blend in with the Gothic design of the cathedral, as I said earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah. Instead, it was more like Brunelleschi's dome back in Florence, which we know he was a big fan of. Right. He grew up looking at it like the rest of Florence, of Florentines in his generation and since. It was sort of a Tuscan-style cupola. Mm. On top of it, and he was going to create a double-shelled dome like Brunelleschi's.
Right.
It would be four-sided on the outside, mm-hmm. but on the inside it would be octagonal. But after they got all of the ideas from Bramante and Leonardo and the others, the Milanese authorities still didn't know what to do.
What?
So they called in another expert from outside. This was Francesco Di Giorgio from Siena.
Yeah, it's April of 1490, and they need to bring in an outside expert because they don't. We got all these ideas. What in the hell are we going to do? Now, Francesco, that you just mentioned, 13 years older than Leo. And again, like Leo, he
You
won't,
can't get 13-year-olds out of your brain, can you?
Just It's stuck. It's rammed up in there tight, and it's stuck. But like Leo, he's into art, engineering. I started to say acupuncture. That's not right. Architecture. I'm not stoned right now. This is just me. He traveled to Siena, and actually in Siena, he was in charge of the underground aqueduct system there. So he's an important guy. He's got a very important responsibility, because if that goes, the whole city's fucked. But Milan is asking for a favor, and you don't want to upset the Duke. So he's going to be sent over, but not that everybody's happy about it.
Now, Francesco, like Leonardo, kept pocket-sized notebooks with him at all times, full of ideas on everything. And in 1475, he'd begun collecting ideas about architecture because he wanted to write a new book on architecture, which he thought of as sort of a successor to the one that Alberti had written.
Right.
I don't know, 100 years earlier or so.
Good for him.
And he wanted his to be for builders, not for scholars, and so it was going to be written in everyday Italian, not in Latin.
All right.
But like Leonardo's notebooks, Francesco's were filled with drawings and discussions about machinery, churches, weapons, pumps, hoists, urban designs, fortified castles.
Yeah.
He was another great thinker, like Leonardo. Right. Like he thought about it, he wrote about it, and in the end, Milan decided they wanted him to design the tower, and Leonardo dropped out.
Fuck you guys. Fuck y'all. I'm out. Yeah. So, but at least he tried. He tried to get into the architect and engineering part of it. Hopefully another opportunity will come along.
Right.
Yeah.
But the important thing is that he became friends with these two guys, right. Bramante and Francesco. Now, in 1490, the authorities in the town of Pavia, about 25 miles away from Milan,
mm-hmm.
wanted to build a new cathedral. They knew what was going on in Milan, and so they asked Sforza if they could borrow his guys as consultants.
Right.
And it's funny, like apparently the his Sforza's secretaries, when he was talking to them about it, he goes, look, I got this request from Pavia. And they were like, send Leonardo, man. Just, you know Leonardo.
Yeah.
He'll go anywhere. Yeah, he'll go anywhere, do anything, drop of a hat.
Right.
He loves it.
Yeah.
Can't get enough.
Yeah.
Any problem, he's like the goodies. Any problem, anywhere, right. anytime, anyhow, he'll go do it. And so they figured if they sent Francesco, Leonardo would want to go too.
Right.
So they went and consulted to the people of Pavia. Now, on the trip, Francesco talked to Leonardo about his book on architecture, which Leonardo eventually acquired a copy of when it was published. But they also discussed another book. In the Visconti Library in the castle of Pavia which had like 1,000 books in it, there was a beautiful manuscript copy of Vitruvius's book on architecture.
Mm.
Now, we've talked about Vitruvius, I think, before when we were talking about Poggio Bracciolini right. and these guys that were the manuscript collectors. But just to remind people, Vitruvius was a Roman military officer and an engineer, lived in the first century BCE. I think he was one of Augustus's guys. Mm-hmm. And he wrote this book on architecture, which had been rediscovered relatively recently,
yeah.
been lost, obviously, like everything else for 1,000 years. It had been recently discovered. And it was in Latin.
Yes.
Now, Francesco wants to write his book in Italian, and he'd been struggling to compile a translation of Vitruvius from Latin into Italian. Mm-hmm. There were many variations in manuscript copies that had been made of Vitruvius, but he wanted to study the 14th century copy of it that was in Pavia in the library of the Visconti.
Nice.
And so did Leonardo, and that is what is going to give us Vitruvian Man.
Yes.
But I think we'll have to leave that to the next episode.
Yes. And the good news for Leo is that the church that they're going to go look at in Pavia that's going to be worked on is less Gothic than what's going on in Milan. So you know Leo's loving that because, let's face it, the stuff that Florentines do is generally more aesthetically pleasing than the Gothic look. So, again, it's just all around good for Leo.
You have to always get the last word in, don't you? Last word Harris, that's what they call you.